You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish, and Communications Workers Local 6360. Since 1983, Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients both in Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at bktplaw.com to contact us for a free consultation. And CWA Local 6360 represents workers who build and maintain AT&T's communications network and 911 dispatchers in Jackson County and Independence who make sure citizens get the life-saving help they need. Local 6360 also represents union printers and screen printers in Kansas City and St. Joseph, as well as technicians at Mood Media. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, the attack on public education is nothing new, but recent legislation coming out of the Missouri legislature has public school teachers fighting back. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll talk to Jess Piper, a teacher, about the school voucher program and its impact on Missouri education. Then, novelist Eric Lotke tells us about his new book called Union Made. That's made by union. It's a modern-day love story set during an organizing campaign in a big box store and the unlikely romance between a union organizer and an accountant who works for a sleazy corporate raider. Will love or money win? Stay tuned to find out. In the news, Veterans Administration Union wins case that the Trump management bargained in bad faith. And HUD Secretary Marcia Fudge meets with KC tenants and promises to investigate Millennium. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, and we're going to be talking about Biden's new appointment to the National Labor Relations Board. Now for the news.
From our side, May 27th, 2021. The National Veterans Council of the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, won an arbitration victory in a ruling that the Trump-run Veterans Administration, or VA, bargained in bad faith. That's the second bad faith bargaining decision against the Trumpers. The nature of their violations, refusal to provide information the union was legally entitled to, and declaring impasse on non-mandatory subjects of bargaining while negotiating the ground rules. Those are the rules the parties usually agree to before they even begin to bargain. Such violations show either utter disregard or profound ignorance of the law which governs federal workers' union rights. These violations led to a grievance and arbitration which the union won. Not to be deterred by the law, they did it again. The VA administrators reopened and tried to decimate the existing contract, even including a provision to make the union pay VA lawyers and HR officials who were required to participate in grievance proceedings and arbitration hearings. Furthermore, before the first bargaining session in Long Beach, California, the VA failed to secure travel arrangements for several members of the union's negotiation team. Once the parties arrived in Long Beach, the VA failed to promptly provide the necessary equipment and technology for bargaining, in violation of the ground rules. Then they violated many of the standards of good faith bargaining. The union filed 8 bad faith charges, which went to arbitration. In the end, the arbitrator ordered the VA to cease and desist further violations of law and contract, to negotiate in good faith with the council, and to issue a notice signed by the VA secretary saying that VA had engaged in unfair labor practices.
They treat us like prisoners, not human beings. Just because this is a low-income housing doesn't mean they have to treat us low. Those are the words of Sylvester Ellis, a leader of KC Tenants Union, about his landlord, Frank Sinito and Millennia, that owns Gabriel Tower at 16th and Jackson in KCMO. The building, along with 5 other Millennium properties, cater to poor and working class, majority black, elderly, and disabled tenants. Millennia is subsidized by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Despite this, Millennia was one of the biggest COVID evictors in Jackson County and the 11th in the country in terms of HUD subsidies. On Wednesday, the tenant union at Gabriel Tower, supported by KC Tenants, organized a small demonstration at the American Jazz Museum as HUD Secretary Marcia Fudge gave a press conference on the American Jobs Plan. She responded to the union's invitation and met with James Pappy Stone, president of the Gabriel Tower Tenant Union. Fudge committed to take immediate action on the union's demands. She assigned Bruce Ladd, Deputy Regional Administrator of HUD, to launch a full investigation into the Millennia Companies, the owner and manager of Gabriel Tower Apartments at 16th and Jackson. She committed to a follow-up virtual meeting with the full tenant union after HUD completes the investigation within the next 2 or 3 weeks. Secretary Fudge said she was aware of Millennia, a company based in her home state of Ohio. "I will treat you with the respect you are due. Get me the information and I'll get it done," she said. Stone said, "Housing is infrastructure. My home is crumbling while a rich man in Ohio gets even richer. My neighbors are sick and dying. Millennia profits while exploiting us, and HUD funds them to do it. It's got to end, and Millennia has got to go. We expect Secretary Fudge to take action immediately."
They've been talking about this since the beginning of the pandemic, and now they've done it. The Missouri legislature passed a legal shield for businesses to protect them from pandemic-related liability lawsuits. And true to their pro-corporate, anti-working class nature, they did it as their final action of the legislative session. The legislation would prohibit COVID-19 liability lawsuits against businesses and healthcare providers unless plaintiffs can prove that they were exposed and sickened by the coronavirus and that the entity engaged in reckless or willful misconduct. And that's a standard that's very difficult to prove. Religious organizations would be shielded from the COVID-19 exposure lawsuits unless intentional misconduct can be proven. Punitive damages may be awarded in any COVID-19 related action, but shall not exceed an amount in excess of 9 times the amount of compensatory damages. The provisions of this act expire 4 years after the effective date of this act, which is August 28, 2021. This story comes from the law firm of Boyd Kinter, Thomas and Parrish, a member of the Missouri Association of Trial Attorneys, MATA, which opposed the bill because it provides negligent nursing homes and exposes small brick and mortar businesses.
And Labor Notes is offering a summer school on its very popular guide called The Secrets of a Successful Organizer. It's an online course in productive troublemaking at work, aimed at rekindling the flame of rank-and-file militancy. The subjects are, first, beating apathy, second, assembling your dream team, and third, turning an issue into a campaign. The class will be offered on Wednesdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., June 2nd, 9th, 16th, and 23rd, or Thursdays from 6 to 8 p.m. on June 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, actually at the same time as this show. Register for either at labornotes.org and look up under events. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Christina Dismang, and I'm Judy Ansel.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
And that was What Did You Learn in School Today by Pete Seeger. Good evening. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI. I'm Christina Dismay. As a reminder for tonight's show, KKFI does not endorse any candidate or political party. Tonight, we are going to be talking with teacher and 2022 Democratic candidate for Missouri's House District 1, Jess Piper, about what's going on right now with education and the state of Missouri. Jess, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know you've been working in education for about 16 years, but could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what has inspired you to move away from the classroom and now to go headfirst into Missouri politics?
Well, I'm originally from Arkansas, and I've lived in Missouri now for 13 years. I've been a teacher for 16 years. I live on a very small farm in the northwest corner of the state, right on the Iowa border. My husband and I have raised 5 kids, and we have a granddaughter, and we have twin grandbabies on the way very soon. So we're super excited about that. And you're right. I recently resigned my position as an American literature teacher to pursue a state legislator's job. So I'm running for a House seat in District 1 in Northwest Missouri.
Well, it seems like just been a big push. A past 4 years, a lot has happened. A lot has been happening right now in the state of Missouri, especially when it comes to education. Actually, in the past year, there's been many bills in the state of Missouri that have been created either to undermine the teaching position or public education in general. A majority of these bills did not pass. I mean, there's one that did, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. How do these bills, do you think, reflect the attitudes towards education in Missouri, or how in Jefferson City there seems to be a lack of understanding of what's actually happening in the classroom?
Right. Well, it seems that we have people writing bills that aren't teachers and don't understand how to create lessons or the difference between a lesson plan and curriculum that's board approved. So that's problematic. We also have people that are using bills that were created maybe by ALEC, created maybe by the Heritage Foundation. The reason I say this is because the bill that tried to go through in Missouri banning the 1619 Project, it also planned to ban using the words race, racism, oppression, and privilege in classrooms. This bill is the same exact bill that has come up in several red states across the country. And that's not by accident. That is by design. And so the pushback on teaching history, which you would think wouldn't apply to me, but I teach American literature. And so I teach the words of the history of our country. And so I do teach the founders. I do teach the words of enslaved people, the words of people who were fighting for civil rights. I teach the words of women when, you know, they were trying to get the vote. All these people fall under the definition of being oppressed. And that word would basically be banned if that law had gone through or if that bill had gone through. So there's a huge disconnect. I've been teaching this way for a long time. I don't really get pushback from parents. People perceive me one way because they see me online. But in the classroom, I am a professional and I don't ask my kids to believe what I believe. I just ask them to think about what they believe after I give them material. So there's a real disconnect between what's happening in classrooms and what they think is happening in classrooms in Jeff City.
How do you think this does a disservice to that specific bill that ties in with the 1619 Project? How does that do a disservice for students across the state of Missouri?
So if that bill had gone through, I wouldn't be able to teach Martin Luther King Jr. I couldn't teach Malcolm X. I couldn't teach James Baldwin. I couldn't teach slave narratives. So I was talking to another English teacher and we went, you know, just scavenging through our American literature book, and about half of the book would need to be thrown out. It could even reach as far as, I know that they're not going after the Crucible because, you know, that's basically about white folks, but the Crucible could be misconstrued as being about oppression. And so there's also talk of religion in there, and no one can assign blame to anybody for any purpose. And so it's making people's lives, teachers' lives tough. And the thing is, I already know the history and the history teachers already know the history. It's impacting the kids who are going to walk out with a massive hole in their knowledge.
There, and when you think about that, because normally when you're teaching about history, you want to teach about the truth of everything that happens, not just the things that, not cherry picking. Cherry picking throughout history, you have this idea that everything was great, that somehow you don't need to be pushing forward, that you don't need to make things better because they're already so great. And I think that's what the issue is with this bill. It did not pass, but it's still concerning that it could be brought back up in the future, is that it could lead to have this kind of dangerous nationalism that can be pushed forward with this narrative that they're trying to create. So
yeah, and they are. And like I said, it just makes it difficult on kids. The people who are going to miss out here are students. I know that there's been a couple of parent groups. There's nothing in my area that, you know, there's been no eruption of people being upset about this in my area. But I have seen some things going on, you know, in the Rockwood area. And I've read and seen videos of parents, what they were upset about. And if I were going to address that, I know that a mom had said, my child feels bad about being white. And that is something that I have never heard. And I've taught this for years. I've taught in this manner for years. I taught this 1619 project. Well, and when people think it's like a manifesto, it's essays and poems. but I've taught the essays and poems before, and I can tell you, I'm a white person and I teach mainly white people, and my students have never been, "Piper, you know, I'm really embarrassed to be white." But this is what they do say: "Hey, I didn't know this history, and what could we do about this?" So they're not embarrassed of anything. Why would they be embarrassed? There's nobody alive who had enslaved people. So what they think is happening again is that disconnect. There's no one that feels guilty. It's, you know, like climate change. If we talk about climate change, do the kids in my class feel guilty about that? No. Do they think they need to change it? Yeah.
It's having those hard conversations. That's what it should be building towards, is having these conversations in the classroom and not taking away those chances. And what's happening in Jefferson City is not just towards curriculum and what's happening in the classroom. It's also how things are being funded. And there was one bill that was passed out of many of these different bills that were accumulated and created. House Bill 349 was passed earlier this month. And it's a bill that would allow a tax credit that pays for children to attend private schools, basically a pseudo voucher program. Mm-hmm. And at first glance, it looks like this bill would only impact larger metropolitan areas, but that's not necessarily true. How would this bill and or bills like these impact schools in rural communities?
Right. So anytime you pull from general funds, anytime you pull kids out, then you're losing money. And so if kids are going from public school into charter schools or private schools, or even homeschooling could be an option where parents could, you know, have their taxes go that way. It impacts local schools. And you saw a lot of rural legislators and senators with that bill say, "Well, it won't impact my district, so I'm going to go for it," which I find, you know, really awful, because it is impacting larger districts. But I think if I read it right, it could go down to districts as small in communities as small as 30,000 people. So that's not just Kansas City and St. Louis. That's a lot of communities across Missouri that this will impact. And our schools are already underfunded, and they've been underfunded for years. And this just pulls more out of the general funds that rural schools rely on. So all they're doing with these things is making sure that my child goes to a very small school. There's 16 kids in the entire third grade. They're making it where she isn't going to get new playground equipment, or she's not going to have a new textbook in sixth grade. So when they do these things, everyone across the state needs to realize that they're impacting your rural schools. And the thing is, we don't have options out here. They talk about, you know, parents should have options. We don't have any. The closest private school, high school rent is 57 miles from me. I can't drive 57 miles. I need my local school to be funded. And that's what Missouri should do.
And especially talk about like what Missouri should be doing. So what change do you think actually needs to happen in the state of Missouri? Like what change needs to happen to improve Missouri schools across the board?
One, we need to make teaching a priority and paying teachers a priority. We're ranked so low, anywhere from the 48th in the nation to sometimes 50th in some places for teacher pay. You cannot retain teachers. I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, 16 years worth of experience, and I go around the country and teach other teachers how to teach. I make $41,000 a year. And my bring home pay is, you know, is awful after they take, you know, retirement and insurance. And I think that people don't realize that you cannot recruit people if you're going to pay them. Sometimes there's some places in Missouri that the bring home pay after deductions is $400 a year or a month, sorry, a week, $400 a week for a teacher. It's not sustainable. And so we're bleeding teachers to Iowa, to Kansas, to Arkansas, to Illinois. We can't keep them. And it's really important in rural areas because we already have such a high turnover in rural areas. We can't keep teachers. And that is the very first thing that needs to be tackled is teacher pay. And then after that, we have to fund schools. We have to stop messing around with tax credits. We have to stop messing around with charters and private schools and fund public schools.
And since the past few years, you've been teaching for a while, and you have seen that there's been this issue in Missouri's public education system, that what you've seen in happening in Jefferson City, especially within the past 2 years. Have you seen other teachers like yourself starting to say, like, hey, how can we get more involved, like wanting to get more involved? Have you seen that teachers that you've been involved with or that you've talked with kind of saying, like, hey, we need to stand up, we need to speak something, kind of lead in the charge like yourself?
It's dangerous to do what I do because you can easily become targeted in certain districts for standing up and for saying something. I do see a lot of teachers doing it. And actually, I do this for my community, but by me standing up, it allows other people around me to feel safer and stand up as well. So I see people that I work with saying, hey, this doesn't make any sense, or we need to work on these things, especially when COVID happened and a lot of teachers were pushed back into classrooms that weren't safe. You saw a lot of protests and that sort of thing. Teachers are getting braver. And also, I mean, we realize, and honestly, this is, I mean, if my bring home pay is $400 a week, why not say something? I mean, you know, there's a lot of places that can pay you $400 a week. And so you see younger teachers standing up as well, which is not the norm. But yeah, the really sad thing that I see is that I have a big social media base, and a lot of teachers like me, this was it. This is the last year. And there are so many veteran teachers that are walking out this year. It's I said before, there is no teacher shortage. There's a shortage of people willing to work what we're paid. But we might get to the point where there is a teacher shortage, especially in Missouri. And I want to stop right here and say something really quickly. The remedy to a teacher shortage is not to go out and to certify anyone off the street, because you see those bills. You see those bills coming through and you're like, wait, what? If you've ever been in a classroom, and I'd invite people to come in, come sit down and be in charge of 30 young people, 30 different people every hour. keep them engaged, teach them, grade, do all of those things, have a relationship with them. I'd invite you to come do that. It doesn't come, just automatic. It's something that you learn over the years. The teacher I was in 2004 is not the teacher I am in 2021. It's something we need to address. And honestly, I think that we need to have teacher voices helping lead us through this. And that seems to be what's missing in Jeff City as well.
Exactly. You bring up amazing points. And as a teacher myself, those are things that I've been seeing across the board, like what we need to do in the state of Missouri when we need to get our education back on track. And unfortunately, it seems like there's a disconnect between what's happening in Jefferson City and what you actually see in school districts and in the classroom. And for the last question is, where can our listeners find more of your work or find more information? If they want to start following what's happening with education policy in Missouri, where can they go to?
So I'm on Twitter. I am EnglishTeach07. And I am also Piper, the number 4, Missouri. And both of those are my Twitter handles. I'm on TikTok. That's lots of fun. I don't know why everybody is on TikTok. I have a great time there. And I'm just Piper Mo there. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. You can find me pretty much everywhere, just standing on top of the rooftops, screaming something about education.
Well, keep on screaming. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And everyone, that was Jess Piper, a 2022 Democratic candidate for Missouri's House District 1, talking with me, Christina Dismink, about what is happening in Missouri when it comes to education.
Spring has sprung and it's time for funds. That's FUNDS, as in KKFI's 2021 Spring Fund Drive. And we're asking you to do your part by volunteering for our phone bank. This is your opportunity to support the station through a donation of your time by taking calls during the Spring Fund Drive. And the best part is, you can participate at the station or remotely. Just point your browser to kkfi.org/phonebank for more information.
PeaceWorks KC will hold its 10th Memorial Day Witness for Peace on Monday, May 31st from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. A peace walk begins at Prospect and Missouri Highway 150 and concludes near the National Security Campus at 14510 Botts Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Learn more at peaceworkskc.org. This is a public service announcement of KKFI.
My name is Mike Stout. In March 1970, I worked at the Grand Central Station Post Office in New York City at Lexington and 45th. We were making $2.95 an hour. We had no benefits. We had no grievance procedure. We had no rights whatsoever. Local in the Bronx called for a walkout. Grand Central Station was the first one to walk off the job, and we led a nationwide wildcat strike. So I'd like to dedicate this song to all you postal workers out there, carriers and clerks. The original was by the Kingsmen. This is by the Working Men.
Vicious hatchet man, just another bot for the Koch brothers.
Good evening, and welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi, bringing you, our Kansas City audience, and people streaming live from around the country, hopefully, a very special bit of programming tonight. We've got Mr. Eric Lotke, fiction writer, labor advocate, attorney. He's also with the National Education Association, and we'll be discussing his latest release from Hardball Press, Union Made. It's about the unlikely romance between a hedge fund accountant and a fiery union organizer in the midst of a bitter power struggle against a big box retailer. Any of this sound familiar? It should. From McDonald's to Amazon to Walmart, here we are talking about Nate Hawley and Catherine Campbell and Pack Shop that brings them all together. And it's all the original creation of Mr. Eric Lotke. Eric, welcome to the Kansas City and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
First, I would like to talk a little bit about where the book came from, like what inspired you, and then we're going to ask you to do a little bit of a reading, maybe if you can.
Excellent. I hope so. So where it came from, and stop me if I say more than I ought to around here, I kind of grew up being labor skeptical. I do not come from a union family. I do not bleed union. At the beginning of my career, unions were annoying. And then somewhere along the line, I figured out how important unions are. Mm. Unions are the folk who brought us the weekend. Unions are why, during my teenage job, I got time and a half overtime. Unions are hugely important. And I figured that out and went to work for a union. Now, meanwhile, I write fiction in my spare time. I write novels. This is not my first. I hope you'll enjoy them. And I said to myself, I want to write a novel about union organizing. I want to show this really cool campaign stuff that's going on around me that I'm working on. And I want to show this development, really, that I had that a lot of people could have about going from anti-union to pro-union, learning what they do and why it's important. And so I was trying to figure out, how do you do this? How do I get the guts, the heart and soul and the guts and the mechanics of a campaign? And I want to tell that campaign story, and it's thrilling to me, and it's really interesting to me. It might not be interesting to other people. The eureka moment was the romance. The eureka moment was, wait a minute, people like a romance, so we need to build the whole thing around the romance. So what we have is a classic romance. It's a boy meets girl. It's all of the traditional tropes. He is an accountant who works for the, as you called it, hedge fund managers, the investors who own the corporation. She is a union organizer who's trying to organize the big box store that he invests in. So they are naturally adverse. They're naturally on opposite sides. But of course, he's lonely and pining. She is super fabulous and an organizer. And so, like any other smart guy, he starts getting interested in her. And so what we see is him waking up to what she's doing and why she's doing it, sometimes by dialogue, because they talk to each other, even though they're across the table, sometimes because he's reading the company's books and he sees what they could afford to give in wages and he sees what they're actually giving,
right,
and he knows what they could afford. So we have these things going on, and eventually he comes around to her side.
And that's what I was going to ask you. So one of my questions was, it's not that I'm leery of artists who cross into activism or activists who sometimes do some art, but I was curious what came first for you. Was it that you wanted to tell a story about organization, or was literary fiction something that you got involved in also as well?
I write nonfiction for a living. I write nonfiction in my day job. I haven't lawyered in a long time, but I used to be a lawyer. It's all nonfiction, or you act as if it is.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it's all human interest. It's all human stories. That's what's so interesting, and that's what's so important. And it was, I guess, three novels ago that I figured out, wait, storytelling is also a path to social change. Storytelling is also a way to get things done. Half of our political universe thinks they live in fiction written by Ayn Rand. So maybe we can have other fiction that drives in other directions.
And so do you have a little segment? We're going to be cut a little bit short on time, but maybe a couple minutes of a passage that you found that you would like, that our Kansas City audience can enjoy listening to?
I can do that. So the book is written alternating chapters. I'll read one of each. Nate gets only one little paragraph. He opens it with chapter one, and it looks like this. Nate Hawley stirs the onions and snaps at his television. They'll move the jobs overseas. Then where will you be? Nate's apartment is a tidy little space in Richmond, Virginia. The TV chatters from a shelf with books he hasn't touched in years. You can't have high wages and low prices, he advises the strikers on the stream. He didn't catch what they're striking about. Is their factory moving to Mexico? Striking won't help. That's Nate, our fuddy-duddy accountant. You meet him in chapter one. I'll try to slow it down and get it right and enunciate better for Catherine. She's chapter two. It's alternating chapters like this. And Kate begins with, okay, guys, says Catherine Campbell, we have their attention. Now we need to step it up. Catherine is in the local headquarters of the United Commercial Workers Local 429. Outside, it looks like a derelict warehouse district with vacant buildings and a used car lot. Inside, it looks like a bus station at rush hour, bustling with activity and littered with old coffee cups and pizza boxes. Catherine is in the center room, a big square space with folding tables and chairs left wherever people used them last. To two dozen people are looking at her. Tax shop employees and coalition partners from the community, all in red T-shirts, the unifying color for the campaign. Catherine is wearing a red work shirt unbuttoned over a black tank top. Her dark blonde hair is cut short and practical. She tells the crowd, "We know we have their attention because yesterday they issued a press release calling us everything but communists. Store traffic is down nearly 20% since we started. Nobody wants to cross a picket line." A few people interrupt with applause. "You can clap at that," Catherine says. That gets a few laughs and a new round of applause, so she pumps it up more. "What do we want?" she calls out, initiating a cheer they've done many times before. "A raise," the people cry. "When do we want it?" "Now." Catherine repeats the cheer to rally the crowd. This is her action nucleus, fired up and ready to go. "Today we have three actions," she says. "Both stores plus a new third location." "The mayor," someone shouts. Catherine doesn't notice who. "That's right," she affirms, "the mayor. Today we demonstrate in front of City Hall." Catherine reiterates what they know, which is that Pack Shop can afford to wait them out. Pack Shop has plenty of profits to cover any costs, and it can sit still for longer than the union can sustain this level of exertion. The union needs to get a third party involved, and they're angling for the mayor. "He's going to step up and take our side," Catherine declares, as if her confidence makes it true. Catherine has had countless meetings with mayoral aides. She's reminded them of the union's financial contributions and the doors it knocked during the campaign, but the mayor himself remains elusive. "A lot of shoppers like their prices," his chief of staff told Catherine. "You'd rather they leave?" Catherine can't keep waiting. She needs to push the mayor to take a side with the workers, not the corporation. She's gambling that when the microphone is in his face, the mayor will say the right thing. Today's action is designed to get it there. So there we go.
Perfect.
That's the setup. Now,
thank you so much. No, I appreciate you. Yeah, that was great. I guess one of the things that I wanted to know, I know that the line between between fiction and reality, and sometimes between nonfiction and fiction is sometimes blurred. I was curious if there was any sort of real life analog to some of the stuff that you're talking about in your fiction. Was there any particular campaign that inspired you, or people that were involved in those campaigns that inspired you? Can you tell us about that?
I would say the whole thing is real life analog. In fact, when I showed a draft of that chapter that I just read to a union organizer, he read it and he said, "Where's the pizza boxes? You need pizza boxes."
Right.
And so that had pizza boxes in it. I put them in there next to the coffee cups.
You know what? It is so funny. I hate to cut you off, but I'm so excited about... So when you mentioned the pizza boxes, I think that I know the section that you're talking about. And if I don't, maybe there's a few of them in here. There's a part in there where... like maybe it was the union hall was a mess, or like an area of the shop was a mess, and it was where they had done some campaigning stuff. And he was like, "No, this isn't a mess. This is sort of like these are souvenirs. These are sort of like holy artifacts of what we're doing here."
Where the paint spilled.
Yeah, where the paint spilled. Where they were making the pig, right? Where they were painting the pig.
Painting the pig, right?
Yeah.
So there's research like that, like pizza boxes, and I want it to feel real where they're spilling paint. Mm. And then there's things like, again, the setup that we just heard. They want to take it to the mayor. That's because there's subsidies going on. And so this big company is not only not paying its workers a living wage, it's getting subsidized with economic development grants to do it. That's research, and I do research, and I do research in my day job, and I did research in this book. I was reading the SEC filings of companies like Walmart to make this company look and feel real, so that the bottom line that's being discussed is actually a bottom line that comes from reality. The story is entirely fiction. Everything about it is imaginary, but the inside of the jail cell looks like the inside of jail cells that I've spent time in. The police are doing things that police do, and the union organizers are doing things that union organizers do. Actually, forgive me if I can keep the mic. Back to those pizza boxes that make it real. The other thing that's going on in this very scene getting set up like this, not only that Catherine is organizing the workers, but there are community partners in the crowd as well. Community partners are also wearing the red T-shirts, and you really need the community involved to support something like a strike. As the mayor says, you'd rather they leave. People like the jobs. People like the low wages. You don't want them to go. The previous speaker just now was talking about vouchers and talking about teachers. I was involved in some of those Red for Ed teacher strikes for higher wages, and we want the teachers to be paid better. We want them to have freedom over the curriculum, and we need the community to be involved in that, because if nothing else, if the teachers are on strike, who's watching the kids during the day? You need the teachers involved, and in this case, Pack Shop. They need the shoppers involved. They need them front and center, and they need them to say, yeah, you got to pay these people better, not I like my low prices.
Wow. Yeah, you know, there's so much going on, and I've noticed there are a lot of I read some, like Thomas Pynchon, for example. He does kind of sort of corporate dystopian style novels, and I noticed there's some hints of that here. And so if you are in our listening audience and you're looking for something to pick up, I would absolutely suggest Union Made by Eric Lotke, along with some of his other efforts. This comes out of Hardball Press. Eric, I'm so sorry that we are kind of running out of time, but can you let our listeners know where they would be able to pick up your books?
They can pick up the book any place. Forgive me, not Amazon. If you can buy it not from Amazon, but you can buy it from Amazon, your local independent bookseller. And I love it that you're talking about dystopian fiction, but honestly, it's a romance. I want you to have a good time. You should have a good time reading it. And in between the lines, you get to learn a lot about unions and activism and how to build a campaign. But fundamentally, have a good time with it. Union Made.
And so our in Hardball Press, is that right? Is that where they can also get it?
Or and Hardball Press, and you can buy it direct from Hardball Press. It's hardballpress.com, I think. Direct from Hardball Press, from your local bookseller, from Amazon if you have to. Uh-huh. No one will have it on the shelf. Everybody will have it for you by Thursday.
Thank you so much, Eric. We appreciate you joining us from the Heartland Labor Forum. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Workers. With us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Mark Runberg. How you doing, Mark?
I'm fine. Thank you, Judy. But it sounds like somebody hasn't hung up a phone. There we go. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, well. It's been a challenging show. Anyway. So we're going to talk about the fact that Biden is going to nominate or has already nominated a labor attorney named Gwen Wilcox to fill the empty seat on the National Labor Relations Board. Is this good news or bad, Mark?
Good news. She's a pro-worker labor lawyer. She represented the fight for 15 and their fight with McDonald's to get the $15 an hour wage and a union at all the McDonald's around the country. I should tell you something about her. She's also the associate general counsel for SEIU 1199. In Manhattan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's a good one. She's also, if confirmed, be the first black woman ever on the NLRB.
You know, that really shocked me. They've never had somebody who's black. They have, but not a woman, right, on the NLRB?
Correct. Okay. Matter of fact, the number of women is pretty rare, too. Right now, the board is three GOP white guys and Lauren McFadden, who's the lone Democrat and the lone woman. She's
right.
Also the chair of the board.
Explain this, because she still won't make the Democrats have a majority on the board. So what is it, that the board was actually underfilled under Trump? Is
Correct.
That it?
Correct. It was underfilled under Trump. Until McFadden was confirmed late last year, it actually was 3-0, three Republicans, nobody else.
So,
and, Yes.
Now, obviously, I know what it was like. There were some terrible decisions for labor coming out of the board.
Right.
But it's also the responsibility of the president to fill those positions when they become vacant, and Trump just didn't do it. Is that correct?
Correct. Trump didn't do it, and he didn't want to do it.
Okay, so if Wilcox gets confirmed, which will happen by the Senate, then it'll still be 3-2 in favor of the Republicans on the NLRB. When will that change?
That'll change in August, because the next Republican term expires in August. It's a guy named William Emanuel who's been rife with conflict of interest. He's a Los Angeles Republican labor lawyer. And it's pretty much a given that they're not going to renominate him. And the board is set up so that the president's party, the party that holds the White House, is supposed to have 3 seats, and the other party is supposed to, or top parties are supposed to have 2.
Okay, so that causes lots of questions. First off, can Wilcox get confirmed by the Senate?
Yes. No filibusters allowed for lower level nominees anymore.
Okay, so are there any Democrats who would vote against her?
I can't think of any right now. Even Sinema and Manchin, I have a feeling would go along with this one.
Okay. Okay. Good. So, but then it doesn't look like we're going to get any decent decisions out of the NLRB until the Democrats take the majority. Is that right? And that's August.
Well, not quite. Because what the NLRB usually does is it'll delegate each case to a 3-person panel, and even as soon as Biden took over, even with a 3-1 GOP majority, all of a sudden the majority saw which way the wind was blowing and started rolling things back. Uh-huh. And if you put a 3-person panel with 2 Democrats, Wilcox and McFadden, on it, and 1 Republican, then, of course, you get positive decisions.
Okay, so what difference is this going to make in terms of cases that are coming up with the board?
Right now there are a couple of pending cases that are medium big, things like whether they're going to roll back the joint employer mess and also lock down allowing TAs and RAs to unionize, although this is one of those where even the GOP majority saw which way the wind was blowing and decided to reverse course. But there are things like that. No real big tickets just yet.
Okay.
Look for those down the road.
Well, the joint employer case, which would allow workers, for instance, at McDonald's franchises to actually unionize and include McDonald's as the employer, the parent company, that'll make a huge difference too, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes, it would, because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of fast food workers around the country. McDonald's alone has 3,000 franchises, or 2,000 franchises, and 95% of its restaurants are joint employers, if you will. You
know,
owned by the local guy, but it has a McDonald's franchise.
Okay,
and those are the workers, like in Kansas City, who are not getting $15 an hour.
Right, and they sure aren't. Okay, well, we're out of time, but thanks for this. This gives us some hope. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Talk to you next month.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. You can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. And I also want to give a shout out to the KC Activist Calendar, which you can subscribe to if you just email gkcactivistcalendar@gmail.com. That's also on this calendar, which is on our Facebook page. So the 2021 DC Labor Film Fest is still going on. It goes on until June 6th. They have a new film every week, and just Google DC Labor Film Fest to find it. Kansas City CLU, Coalition of Labor Union Women, is doing a food drive for our UAW brothers and sisters in need while they are laid off from work. Donations of non-perishable items can be taken to the American Postal Workers Union Hall at 3824 East 16th Street by the big old post office. And you can drop them off through the end of May between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Community of Reason this week has the business model of education, A Stroll by Money River, Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. Go to communityofreasonkc.org to get a link. Why Safe and Welcoming WICO, a webinar on why Wyandotte County needs ICE noncompliance and a community ID. This is Tuesday, June 1st at 6 p.m. You can register online. Go to Safe and Welcoming Wyandotte on Facebook for registration. 2021 Online Great Labor Arts Exchange. This is your chance to avoid going to D.C. and actually doing it online. It's called Singing Through Hard Times, June 17th to 20th, on Zoom. Email info@laborheritage.org in order to get more information. And finally, the Polk School, a two-day labor leadership training for women workers, is June 24th to 26th at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Apply online today. There are scholarships. Look for Regina V. Polk Women's Labor Leadership Conference on Facebook. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called How We Failed Essential Workers. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's River City Chautauqua.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
For the common man's rights, to be in the working class is good enough for me. Can do.